Okay, I think we're running now. We're talking about the Von Braun team.
Well, I don't know if how really to answer this because, you know, if you're directly involved, it's very hard to judge these things. You get used to certain habits. I think Von Braun has very much to do with it. One thing, for example, he hated more than anything else is to order somebody to be convinced. He tried always to convince, you know, the last guy in a room, maybe we had 10, 12, 30 people, but he made an effort saying that, you know, he could convince people that this was the right way to go, or this was the right thing to do under such and such circumstances, which, you know, they often took a long time, but even if you were controversial, you know, for example, you once in a while thought the time had come that you thrown something in the pot, you know, not that you were convinced it should go this way, but as a new idea, and it was discussed, and very often you didn't even vote for your own suggestion, you know, because it makes no sense if everybody's against it, but conditions like this develop, but I mean, all these things were done with reasoning. So if you understand the reasoning, I think 90% of the time he was able to bring us to that point. And so why feel bad about it?
Okay, so then Von Braun was able to convince, say, the committee or team members. Was there ever an occasion when the reverse ever occurred, when Von Braun was convinced by some other group of individuals or people?
I couldn't get that. I could, if you go back, you know, let's go back to the army days, you know, let's assume, you know, we had a very strong commander here the last 4 years, and specifically the 56, 57, until the 58 Medeiros was directly involved only with us. See, later on he had the whole arsenal, but in the very beginning he was strictly ABMA commander. He was willing also to listen to Von Braun and backed up by our arguments, you know, but then he could once in a while say, now look, fellas, I honor your honest technical opinion, but based on this opinion, I will lose a battle. So I have to do better, you know, either in time or in performance. Now how much can you stretch your imagination, you know? How much we can squeeze out of it? And then we went back in the session, you know, we said input and you massage it again, you know, because, you know, an engineer basically works with safety factors, you know. But yes, the safety factors or the promises you can make on this, you know, that you can, as we later said, we learned the famous word risk assessment. In that time, we didn't use this type of language of a risk assessment. To fly a Saturn finally meant, you know, you couldn't guarantee it, you know, you had to make an assessment what is the risk involved, see.
Is risk assessment, do you come out with a figure that's different than your 9.99 something reliability?
Oh yeah, yeah. So risk assessment
is calculated on probability?
Well, you need first this, what you just said, in a perfect condition, you see. But above and beyond this, you have influences which let's assume you lose an engine at a certain given time. You see, then the risk assessment is against get you the crew away from the disaster. So that's the reason we have today still the escape tower, which is carried along for about 3 minutes of flight time, or even a little longer. I don't know exactly when it comes on. But at least it's on until you have ignition of second stage and a little down, and then we discard that thing. But up to this time, you know, under all conditions, this thing is strong enough to pull the crew away from whatever happens on the rear end of the booster. But as long as you talk naturally weapon systems, you know, you don't need that. You know, you are right, you say every missile hits the target. But I haven't seen a commander yet, he wouldn't fire 3 rounds if the target is very important, you know.
I was wondering too about specific problems that developed during the course of the Saturn program. The S2 stage created some problems. It became a pacing item, finally. Do you remember that time and what you did to cope with it?
I remember that only too well. I was stage manager for a year, 64, okay, yeah. In the middle of the year. Well, actually, it's typical, you know, for the interface between, you know, the government and the contractor, what happens there, to a certain extent at least, you know. Let me start from the beginning. When the contract was signed with North American, it was the diameter was 260 inches, and the thing had 4 engines. And a year later, we found out, or within the first year, we found out we needed more thrust and more horsepower of it, so we thing got thicker. We made it 396, so it's the same diameter now as the first stage. And we added an engine. Now, naturally, to overcome again the more weight or whatever, you know, whenever you make it bigger, you add to it. So we then started considering what can we do to make that thing lighter. And I still have it here. Maybe excuse me a minute. Stop. Thank you. This was a big driver for our CD. Well, maybe we start over again. We say now the S2 stage was, after it had been changed to the present version, we had to find means and ways to make it as light as possible to get a better performance. And in doing so, naturally, we got in more problems than we anticipated. Now, the program mixture ratio change was no problem whatsoever, but it brought us about 2,600 pounds payload. It's just in between these two. By just changing the program mixture ratio change, as I just explained, I think you can remember these figures. And it was between 5.5 and 4.5. This was the limit of the engine in mixture ratio per weight. And we run it finally under 5.4 and 4.7, I think, were the actual values that we finally went to. But this could be verified any time today. Then, other things were considered, as you see here. We reduced the shell. I don't know if you don't see it right now here, but we made a decision to reduce tank pressures, and we redesigned the common bulkhead. And somewhere must be a weight thing I don't see right now. Now anyway, in that time he made already a decision this went in number 4, this change went in number 1. So we staggered the changes. And actually the problem we run into it, we went down with our safety factor, specifically in the aluminum side, so far that we had finally a welding problem. And in reality, it was not a welding problem. We had requirements that the welds were so perfect that you barely could make it. And another thing happened here again when we made the very first decision, for example. North American preferred to stay with their material they had chosen, which was 2014 T6 aluminum. And we had suggested you should go to 2219, which we used on the first stage with Boeing.
Didn't Douglas use that too?
No, they also on 2014.
Why did you suggest using this? Different strength characteristics?
No, 2014 has quite some amount of copper in it, and it is very critical to weld, to get good welding out of it. It's almost an art. But North American and previous missiles had experiences 2014, and they rather said they would stay with it. And 2219 was in that time pretty new in the market, and the experience was really not too broad, you know.
Even though it had, I would guess, less copper in it, would be easier to weld than you thought?
Yeah, it was a different company. I don't exactly, I only know the numbers, I don't recall it, but it's definitely preferred if you talk welding. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a newer development.
They used 2014 T6 in at Hound Dog, I think.
Too. Yeah, and I think Douglas had the same thing on the S4 and the S4B. Yeah. But see, Douglas didn't have, they had not this marginal requirement in their structure. I mean, a marginal requirement is the wrong word to say. Maybe they didn't push the design so fast that they were on their last corner. See, mm-hmm. But the S2 really was, I think, from the ratio of fuel to structure, it's the most advanced ever built. It's running better than 92%. That means 8% structure for your total weight if you fly it. Mm-hmm. Including all the engine, whatever you have. This is pretty, pushing the art pretty far. We did another thing on the S2. We have the outside insulation. That means, in other words, you gain about 20% of your strength in your material if you're undercooled to hydrogen temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, whenever you undercool aluminum, aluminum combinations to this type of temperatures, you gain up to 20% strength.
Why didn't Douglas, was it again by the time the S2 came around that there were other advances in cryogenic adhesives and materials of this kind that made it easier to bond it to the outside? As I recall, that's one of the difficulties Douglas had, was bonding it to the outside, and so they went to the inside stuff.
That's right, and they finally licked the inside stuff, and when the 4B came along, over the 4, they didn't want to change systems. Yeah. We learned that the hard way. On the other hand, the logical thing would be to have the outside insulation on the third stage, actually in the stage which goes to orbit, because there you get 100% return of your weight savings, and as I indicated before, in the S2 you only gain about 30%.
Mm-hmm.
But as it was, even in this big figure, so we finally could commit ourselves, you know, to this. You know, we had two things going. We finally talked also about an upgraded J2 engine, which was a third possibility. Would have cost a lot of money to upgrade the engines. We never got that far, but the engine wound up somewhere in between anyway. You know, the engine finally had number one, a better eye specific than guaranteed. Well, normally was always on the upper corner, and the thrust was also in the 4 to 5% region.
Mm-hmm.
Larger than.
You started out with a 200K design J2 and got close to a 238K rating anyway, didn't you, in the first? Yeah.
And the I specific also was on the higher margin of the predicted scale. I think it was 424 and we wound up with 428 or something like this. But the engine people should verify these figures before you use them.
What's the date on that? 1968.
This is the third quarter. I don't even know why I have this here. Maybe it had a nice shiny envelope.
John, do you have any more S2 questions to ask?
Not right now.
Dave, do you have any?
Fine.
Okay, writing. You're writing well? Okay.
Sounds real good. Generally, before we pass too far beyond, I wondered, you know, this laboratory approach is unique here, and I wonder, does it go back to your memory? You were 2 years, but is this more or less date back to Penamundi? The laboratory approach, I wonder who thought this approach up. Was it Dr. Von Braun, or do you remember?
Well, laboratory approach, I don't know what you call it. I don't have a chart. I think I even have a chart from up there here.
Talking with Jane just for
well,
you.
Well, no, Frank has it. I gave it to him.
She gave it to
Ordway.
Oh, Ordway? All right.
Ordway has a copy of this chart.
Well, as far as structure is concerned, this is supposed to make MSFC unique.
See, this was total Penamundi.
And
this was unique. This was R&D. This was production. This testing. And this was it. See, and then have here in your R&D, you have S&M, your structure mechanics, electromechanical, you know, and ground support. And then naturally the product assurance or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that's a little different than we are here, basically.
Then we started up like this and we wonder what that means.
These are some of these files I was telling you about that Ordway hasn't gotten.
Now, he got a lot of copies from me. He was here not too long ago.
But he didn't get the originals, did he?
Are you sure about that?
Okay. And you had in here project design, guidance and control, chemistry, test, you know, whatever you want to call it.
This is 1947.
Then 48, they had the first.
These are real important.
Does Fred have copies of this?
Yeah. I think I met you once in his house.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is then, see, we grouped it then in five groups, if you want to call it this way, you know. Maybe this was a special outfit, but again, Buchholz had all the guidance and control stuff here, you know. Whatever you want to call guidance and control. And four was Doc Chilling, which now is up with Raytheon. And he had all the tests, you know, Hamburg was his second man. Test method. And Roth, you know, which we finally wound up in Pat, you know, Roth, he had all the three groups here, which is Hellebrand is still here, and Ratzinger is still here, and Schulte is here, and Paul is here. He had all what is today astronautics, see?
Yeah.
And this was number one was a special group. See, this one, that time we played a lot around with the ramjet business. So again, you found a lot of people two times because this ramjet was kind of project office, which you want to call this way, and he pulled people in. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So you had even a committee here. And this was, I think, was summer 48. But this was only our group. See, now we were supported at least by three times the number of General Electric personnel, but I don't have their chart. So they were, you know, it's kind of support contractor to us on the Hellman's project.
1948 would date back to, was this in Fort Bliss?
These two charts, these post charts are Fort Bliss.
Well, that's great. That's very good to know.